October 8th.
What is the date?
October 8th. All right. Randy, you ready? Here we go. How is that?
Excellent.
All right. All right. Good morning, everyone. This is Commissioner Brian Culk. We're meeting the 12th floor of the Capitol today for our regularly scheduled meeting. It is Wednesday, October 8th, like I said, approximately 10 a.m. I guess we've got a pretty good schedule today. I just have one opening comment, if you'll indulge me for a minute. I just looked at the calendar today being October 8th. It was 24 years ago today that Sergeant Brian Culk deployed in support of Operation Desert Storm. And so my wife reminded me of that today. And the only reason I bring that out is that the ultimately I think that the time in Desert Storm led me to this job. There's no question about it, because it was when I was over there when Hussein lit the oil fields on fire. I remember that in my mind it solidified the nexus between energy security and foreign policy, which ultimately I think walked me to this position. So it's very interesting today watching what's going on over there with ISIS and all those things. I mean, the Middle East is a hotbed of turmoil, and it's going to be that way forever. And I think the more energy we develop at home wisely is a good thing. So that's my pontification for today. Commissioner Christman.
Well, I learned something there. So at that point, you were a sergeant.
I was a sergeant.
And then after that deployment, went to officer candidate school.
Absolutely.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
I couldn't command the 1st Marine Division as a sergeant.
Thank you for your service and the rest of the troops. A couple of things that I just wanted to comment on briefly. I had a number of interesting things that I've attended in the last weeks since we last met. One was the Petroleum Council meeting out in Dickinson. And, you know, among a lot of interesting speakers, I just have to say one thing that they do there that I really like is they start off the meeting with a public information meeting. And we're in this business, and so sometimes I don't get anything really new that I hadn't already heard. But they usually have Lynn Helms and Kathy Nesset there. And so most times I still do learn something, even though I'm in this business. This time Allison Ritter filled in very well for Lynn Helms. But what I really like about the public information sessions that they have at the Petroleum Council meetings is I'm able to go there and a bunch of the general public is there, and it's a great opportunity to talk with those folks and hear what they're thinking instead of always just what the players that are up here frequently are thinking. Then we also had the Lignite Energy Council, which had some excellent speakers, and we addressed this at our last meeting when we approved them, but it was certainly an honor to give our reclamation awards to the Falkirk Mining Company for their Coal Lake project, and also, by the way, attend that dedication a few weeks ago. And then also to, as you were mentioning, our own Jim Deutsch for 40 years of service in that reclamation department.
And what was the name of the operation we honored?
The Figgenskau project.
Figgenskau. You can never say that enough. All right. All right. Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchak?
Just to play off of your opening comments, Brian, congratulations on that milestone. And
it just stuck out of my mind today.
And I see that you got a new crew cut to celebrate.
Yes, I did, actually.
Very appropriate.
Doesn't get messed up on the motorcycle.
Oh, good. Also, in keeping with your comments about the energy security issues that were brought to your mind during that time period, also at the oil conference, I noted during a speaker from, I think his name is Jeff Miller from one of the big oil companies, Halliburton, he was speaking, and he noted that our oil imports since the development in the Bakken started, and then you know a lot of other fracking-related development in the U.S., our imports of oil have decreased 18%. Significant improvement and a significant increase in our national security. And at the same time, he also said that the U.S. is on course to be the world's largest oil producer by 2015. So there's no doubt there's a lot going on in the Bakken. We all feel that. We see it in our workload. We see it in our caseload and in some of the balancing acts that we're facing in North Dakota, trying to address the needs of this very growing, vital, important industry, as well as the needs of the citizens that are living and working here every day. So I think you brought up a good point, and I see how it's interesting how things have evolved in the several decades since that time. And in Desert Storm, which, by the way, my husband was also.
That's right, a good sailor.
In Desert Storm, so over there in the Middle East.
So we should sign you and your kids up for the American Legion and the VFW. Excellent.
Yes.
That's all right. Good enough. Okay, thank you, commissioners. We have several items on consent. I would move passage of the consent items.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
All right, thank you, Daryl. Before I get to item BK1, Commissioner Crispin asked me that he'd like to hold over item JF5. So in case I forget when we get to that item, we'll just hold that over. And then, Randy, you'll have to let us know if you want a work session or what you might want when we get to discussion and scheduling.
Okay, and then also I'd like to reverse the order of RC4 and RC5. RC5 kind of plays off of RC3.
Okay, that'd be fine with me. Commissioner Fedorchak, is that okay to reverse?
It's fine, yep. I already did that in my notes.
Okay, perfect. All right, well, let's get right to it then. For item BK1, I move the commission issue a notice of opportunity for hearing in Blue Jay Wireless LLC designated eligible carrier application case number PU14-720.
Second.
In September of this year, Blue Jay Wireless, a limited liability company with offices in Addison, Texas, filed an application to be designated as an ATC carrier for the purpose of federal universal service support and also to be given lifeline-only designation. So basically, we've set up that comments and requests for hearing must be received by close of business November 21st this year, 2014. And if we don't have any requests for hearing, we can do this with an informal. Since they've changed the rules, they'd be in the FCC on whether companies no longer have to have a storefront. In North Dakota, we're seeing a lot of these, so we'll look forward to the informal or formal if requested on this.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Thank you, Daryl. Item BK2. I move the commission acknowledge the September 23rd, 2014 electronic submittal of the 2015 Pipeline Safety One Call Grant application in the amount of $10,000 to the U.S. Department of Transportation Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, known as PHMSA, Washington, D.C., for the development and conduct of a damage prevention awareness campaign, PSC 2015 One Call Grant application, case number GS14-723.
Second.
The long and short of this one is every year about this time, we request $10,000 to help spread the awareness of the campaign. And what this really comes down to is we put bids out for billboards. In the past, it's anywhere from 15 to 20 billboards are authorized around the state. We put them up with the 811 call before you dig. And so we put the grant application in now. And then by the time it comes back through, hopefully, then these will be put up probably next April or May. So we do put it out for bids. It's part of the 811s. And so just so you know, all the billboards around the state certainly are not covered by this grant. One call pays for them as well. MDU, Ottertail, XL all kick in a little bit. But there are a certain number of those that come because of this grant application.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, motion is approved.
All right, thank you, Daryl. Item BK3. I move the commission acknowledge the September 24th, 2014 electronic submittal of the 2015 Natural Gas Pipeline Safety Program base grant application in the amount of $335,022 to the U.S. Department of Transportation Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, Washington, D.C., for the operation and management of the 2015 North Dakota Intrastate Gas Pipeline Safety Program, Public Service Commission 2015 Federal/State Gas Pipeline Safety Grants and Contracts, case number GS14-728.
Second.
This one's also part of the grants that we put into the to PHMSA, if you will. The way this one breaks out is this is the 2015 grant application for what we think the cost will be in that year. So we've totaled up the cost that we believe the cost of operating the program will end up being roughly $335,000. And the way this works is the grant application hopefully comes back approved, and then at some point in time they'll give out the exact percentage of reimbursement that we will get. One thing that I did want to note on this, that in 2013, which is the last year we've received the final reimbursement for, 79.6% reimbursement was given back by PHMSA. And so that this total amount to run this program, 80% of the program cost were covered by the federal government in 2013. So that's actually an increase from what we've seen in 2012, 11, and 10. It used to be in that 60% range. And so I know there's a lot of challenges in D.C. with money and where it's all going to go to, but there has been a concerted effort to increase money to the states for pipeline safety based on a lot of things going on around the country. So we put in our budget for $335. We'll wait to see what the final reimbursement is, but I'm first to criticize the federal government on occasion, and so in this case I want to say it's good to see that they're seeing increased funding availability for pipeline safety. And as we continue the discussion about pipeline safety in the state, we certainly are going to be partners with PHMSA no matter how it all works out on our different programs that we've requested. But for this case, it's 2015, so it's down the road, but this is the time that we put it in. And the costs, really you can break them down into, most of it turns out to be about, you know, a third of it is travel, and the rest comes down to the salary and individual pay for the people. So everything appears to be in order, and thanks, Pat and staff, for putting these last two together.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I would just add a couple thoughts on this. First of all, I think it's important to emphasize that this is for the gas pipeline safety program, which the Public Service Commission has operated on behalf of PHMSA since the 1980s, sometime in the 1980s. We sought that approval from the legislature, went forward, got the jurisdiction to do this program on behalf of PHMSA. Currently, the hazardous liquids program is still managed by PHMSA. That covers all the crude oil lines. And we're looking at seeking that authority in the next legislative session, moving forward to, in which case we'd do something very similar to this, operate the program on behalf of PHMSA and seek reimbursement for some of the costs in that way. I am, like Brian, in applauding the additional federal funds being directed towards this issue, and I think it really highlights the importance and the value that leaders across the country see in pipelines. This country needs pipelines to transport these energy products to consumers throughout the country. It is the fastest, most efficient, most environmentally sound way to transport these products. And we need more pipelines if we're going to be energy independent and have a strong economy that requires these products. So I think this is a great partnership program. It works well, and I look forward to the potential of it expanding this into the hazardous liquids in the future if that's how that all unfolds.
Maybe just one more thought on that, too. I'm not in constant contact with PHMSA, but at least once a month, usually two, three times a month, talk to our counterparts up there. And PHMSA is looking at right now about what their next authorization for the number of inspectors they have in Central Region. So we're trying to verify exactly what the number of inspectors they're going to have and how that might play out in North Dakota. So it's good, the discussion going on, and I think it's very important we keep rolling with it.
Is there any further discussion? Since none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion is approved.
Thank you, Darrell. Item BK4. Believing there will be no prejudice to the rights of the parties or the public interest and finding the cases involve similar questions of law and fact, I move the Commission consolidate under North Dakota Administration Code Section 6902.0404, Northern Excavating Company, Inc.'s Damage Prevention Enforcement Cases, PU 13877, 878, 879, 880, 881, and 882, and 883, and issue a notice of consolidated hearing. In August of this year, the Public Service Commission advocacy staff filed a formal complaint alleging violations of North Dakota One Call and requested the Commission find Northern Excavating, Inc. responsible for violating the One Call law. And this is what I'm going to go through, I guess, very pragmatically. Impose a penalty of $1,000 in case number PU 877, $1,000 in PU 878, $1,500 in PU 13879, $3,000 in case number PU 13880, $3,000 in PU 13881, $3,500 in case number PU 13882, and $4,000 in PU 13-883. This is without question the largest set of fines that have been proposed by the advocacy staff. And so I look forward very much to the hearing on this one. A little bit of background, I guess, before I get too far carried away. The public hearing is set for December 5th at 1:30 right here in the commission meeting room. And we will start with the first case, and we'll go through all seven of them. A little background on this. The last meeting that we had, the commission deemed this a prima facie case, which, of course, set the stage for the filing today. But the companies involved, the complaints were all filed by Reservation Telephone Company, RTC, in North Dakota, which is a North Dakota cooperative based out of Parshall. The company in question here is Northern Excavating. It's a North Dakota corporation located in Jamestown, North Dakota. Basically, we certainly have not decided anything. The staff recommends these fines, and then we'll walk through the hearing process. But all of these deal with the allegation that Northern Excavating damaged fiber optics and related facilities of Reservation Telephone Company, all within the area of course, I lost my notes just now, in the area of Ross, North Dakota. And so that's kind of where they're all going to be centered around, a variety of dates from July 25th, 2013 to September 30th, 2013. So I understand that's been quite a while, but I know staff has done very good due diligence in all these cases, and they wanted to make sure that if it came to this matter, that they had good records backing everything up. And that's one of the things which is different about this case is that, you know, since I guess I got here in 2009, the commission started enforcement on this. It was kind of, you know, crawl, walk, run. And the first case we really walked through very methodically. Ended up where when confronted with the staff doing the investigation, you know, the company in question basically said, yeah, we did this, and you end up with settlement agreements that come into play. But this is the first case where I guess that, in my perception, is that the company that's been accused of violating the law has really dug their heels in, and they've not really given up anything. So staff really tried to work through that, and it ended up, they came up with these recommended fines. So we'll see how this plays out. A lot of these we've seen where there's been settlement agreements that have come through, and that's part of the process. That may happen, it may not, but this is the first time that we've ever seen this. And I should note out that this is a total of almost $17,000 in fines the advocacy staff is recommending. There was over $23,000 worth of damages to the RTC infrastructure. Almost 400 customers were out at different times. So this is a very significant case in front of us. And I should note, too, that on consent, you'll notice that there are also several other cases dealing with Northern Excavating that we've assigned different members of staff on. So we'll have this batch, and then we'll make a determination on that. And there's also another batch, if you will, of Northern Excavating concerns that's coming through. So I very much look forward to the hearing, and I believe that's all that I have.
Commissioner, we'll need a second.
Second.
I got right into my talk and I didn't do the second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, motion is approved.
All right, thank you, Daryl. And finally for me, item BK5. I move the commission submit its notice of intervention and comments to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission related to Southwest Power Pool Inc.'s September 11, 2014 filing, proposing revisions to its tariff to facilitate the integration of the Western Area Power Cooperative, Upper Great Plains Region, Basin Electric Power Cooperative, and Heartland Consumer Power District into the SPP markets and transmission owners.
Second.
Okay, a little bit background on this one. The as many of you are aware of, Southwest Power Pool is working its way into becoming an operating entity in North Dakota. Basin Electric is working through the process of joining them. The North Dakota Public Service Commission will have a role as the individuals who site generation. So between Jerry Lynn and myself and potentially others will be taking a role in Southwest Power Pool like we do for MISO. But in this particular filing, the PSC submits its notice of intervention and comments, in this case, to Southwest Power Pool, dealing with the open access transmission tariff. And what we've really done here is that MDU and Otter Tail have submitted comments to the FERC, and we also are weighing our comments and basically saying we support MDU's comments and Otter Tail's comments because of the significant impact that because of the impact that could go towards North Dakota customers, particularly MDU and Otter Tail. What this really does is the comments that MDU and Otter Tail submitted is they want to make sure that as the two transmission systems get integrated, that MDU gets credit for their transmission. There's basically a mechanism in place that, how will I explain this, that the credits that MDU receives, there's a cost-sharing mechanism back and forth that if Southwest Power Pool is going to use MDU's transmission, they get reimbursed for it. If MDU is going to use Southwest Power Pool, so it's a setup of exchange of costs back and forth that we want to watch this very closely, because if that cost distribution is not fair and equitable, we could find ourselves in front of FERC saying why we don't think that's appropriate. So that's the big thing with MDU on this. And for Otter Tail, a little bit different twist to it. Otter Tail wants clarification that they'll not be assessed any charges for load that is served by facilities in the integrated system between Central Power. And Central Power, of course, serves that area around Minot, and Otter Tail is heavily engaged up in that area. So in my mind, what this really comes down to is MDU and Otter Tail have submitted their comments to the FERC about what they think is needed to make sure that their members are treated fairly as Southwest Power Pool gets integrated. This order supports MDU's and Otter Tail's their filings. And if needed, if we don't like what the FERC decides, then we'll find ourselves in front of FERC. But this will be filed with FERC. So my former colleague, Commissioner Tony Clark, I wonder how that'll work out if he'll have to step aside on this one. We'll have to see. But it's certainly, I appreciate MDU and Otter Tail stepping forward with this and making sure that we had the chance to intervene in support of them.
Do we have a motion and a second? Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
All right, thank you, Daryl. Just, I guess, one thought on the Southwest Power Pool integration. I really think it's a good idea. It's good for North Dakota that Southwest Power Pool is coming in. I think it's going to be good for energy exports. I think it's going to be good for consumers in the state, as long as we make sure we do everything correctly as far as the cost allocation. Because having another transmission provider in the state when we need 3,000 megawatts more of power in the West, I think it really is a good opportunity. We just have to make sure we watch this very, very closely. So, okay, that concludes my items. Commissioner Christman.
First agenda item, RC1. I move the commission accept the Federal Office of Surface Mining's 2014 evaluation report for the coal regulatory program.
Second.
OSM recently issued their evaluation report for the evaluation year that ended on June 30th of this year. No issues or concerns were raised, and OSM continues to report that the commission has an efficient and successful program. I highlighted four excerpts from the report that I just think we should all feel really proud of. First one, based on the topics evaluated this year, North Dakota has an effective program with no issues that need corrective action. Reclamation is occurring as contemporaneously as possible, and the state conducts the appropriate number of mine inspections that are thorough and complete. The second one, the Reclamation Division carries out its duties using the appropriate technical expertise with a high level of professionalism. Number three, North Dakota has met and exceeded the number of inspections required on all mine sites during this evaluation year. And the last one I wanted to highlight, during the evaluation year, no regulatory program problems were issued or issues were identified. No regulatory problems were identified that remain uncompleted at the end of the evaluation year. So based on this report, I recommend the commission accept the OSM's evaluation report for the coal regulatory program.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
Well, just thank Jim and the crew upstairs again for another good year and all the discussion about what's going on in our country nationally with coal. It's just nice to see our guys keep doing it right all the way through and continue to lead the nation in coal reclamation.
Would second those comments.
Any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
RC2, I move the commission adopt an order in case number AU-14-628, granting the request for certification of Southeastern School of Auctioneering of Pelzer, South Carolina, as an approved auction school as required by the North Dakota Administrative Code, Section 69-08-01-01.
Second.
Under that Administrative Code section, an auction school must apply to the commission to have its courses of study approved for use by North Dakota auctioneers. To be approved, of course, a study must require students to complete at least 60 hours of study in the presence of school instructors, with at least 40 hours under the supervision of a licensed auctioneer with at least 5 years' experience, and provide instruction in ethics, bid calling, sales management, advertising, contracts, accounting and bookkeeping, real estate appraisals, closing statements, license law, uniform commercial codes, tax collection, bulk sales, and firearms, among other requirements. The Southeast School of Auctioneering exceeds our required hours, and the school uses a grading system that permits the issuance of diplomas to students who successfully demonstrate competence in all the required areas of study.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
Just to note that it never ceases to amaze me the span of our jurisdiction. Good work, Commissioner and staff.
I was interested in reading more about what auctioneers have to go through to receive their license, and that's quite a long list of coursework that they have to complete. So,
my brother was a licensed auctioneer, so I knew of that it's a pretty detailed and complex program and very interesting, but important. You know, when you go to these sales, there's a lot of things that have to occur to make sure things are done right. So big responsibility for those folks.
Absolutely.
We take them for granted when they're at our pie fundraisers and such. And the big sales. There's a lot of important details to work out.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, motion is approved.
RC3, I move the commission under North Dakota Century Code Section 60-02-09.1 adopt the order suspending warehouse license number 247 of Southam Elevator Company at their Southam, North Dakota warehouse, effective October 1st of 2014, for lack of adequate bond, and issue a notice of opportunity to be heard in case number GE-14-733.
Second.
This grain warehouse bond for Southam Elevator Company is scheduled to expire on October 31st. The Century Code provides that unless the warehouseman files a new bond at least 30 days before liability ceases, the commission, without hearing, shall immediately suspend the license, and the suspension may not be removed unless a new bond has been filed and approved. As of September 30th, a replacement bond was not filed, and the license of Southam Elevator Company was suspended effective October 1st. Southam Elevator Company has until October 30th to procure and file an adequate bond or submit a written request for hearing, although we're fairly confident that that is not their intention. I don't think there's a lot of alarm here about this case. I will tell you that on October 6th, our warehouse inspector was at the Southam facility and verified that their suspension notices and everything were posted. And the elevator company has an inventory worth about $169,000. And all that grain is company-owned except about 1,350 bushels with a value of about $3,700. And we'll get into the resolution on that. But certainly the bond and grain that's there is far more than what we were able to identify as outstanding issues.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
Randy, I was curious what the plans are for this elevator. And are they going to get a new bond, or are they going to close?
Well, I guess they have time to do something different, but our inspector's understanding is that this is going to be closed down.
Okay.
Is there further discussion?
I think you would entertain offers, though.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Okay, then jumping to RC5, I move the commission under North Dakota Century Code number 60-02-10.1 adopt the order authorizing limited operations as requested by Southam Elevator Company in case number GE-14-733.
Second.
As I mentioned, on October 6th, our inspector was at Southam, and they do have their suspension notices posted. And we examined the records. As I said, they have about $169,000 of inventory on hand there. I didn't ask what their bond is, but the bond would still be applicable. But all that grain is company-owned. It's set for 1,350 bushels. Again, the value of that's about $3,700. It's barley. And they have provided a required written notice to that. It's one receipt holder that has that $3,700. They've required that receipt holder with a written notice that the grain must be redelivered or sold by October 31st, which is the projected date of the license revocation. On October 6th, we received a request from Southam to remove the grain in the warehouse so they can satisfy that receipt. And so staff recommends that the commission approve that request to and that's what this motion does, is to operate that warehouse strictly to redeliver grain to satisfy the warehouse receipts.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, motion is approved.
Okay, and then lastly, RC4, I move the commission adopt the order directing response to certain questions regarding the EPA proposed 111D regulations, case number AD-14-736.
Second.
On June 18 of 2014, the U.S. EPA issued a proposed regulation entitled Carbon Pollution Emission Guidelines for Existing Stationary Sources. In the proposed rule, EPA has decided how much coal, natural gas, nuclear, and renewable energy North Dakota and each other state should use, and how much less electricity North Dakota consumers should use. If finalized unchanged, EPA's proposed rule would impose at least a 30% reduction in CO2 emissions from existing power plants in the United States by 2030. The proposed rule contains specific provisions concerning North Dakota. EPA's comment period on the proposed rule ends on December 1st. Our commission held a symposium on EPA carbon regulation on January 22nd and heard from the United States EPA Region 8 Administrator, the North Dakota Department of Health, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, a number of electric utilities, and the interested public. And on September 10th, we held a conference entitled Electric Reliability, Keeping the Lights On in North Dakota. And we heard from a commissioner from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the Mid-Continent Independent System Operation Incorporated, again from the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, a number of electric utilities subject to our jurisdiction, other utilities operating in North Dakota, and the public. The commission now would order that utilities submit comments addressing various issues, such as the EPA's methodology of calculating the proposed emissions, whether the EPA's goals are enforceable, whether the proposal conflicts with this commission's statutorily defined rate setting and resource planning objectives, and whether the proposal raises concern about electric reliability in North Dakota, among other things made clear in the order. We also solicit other stakeholder input, including that from the U.S. EPA and the interested public. The purpose of this order is for the commission to consider the issues and challenges involved in meeting growing demand for adequate and cost-effective electricity in North Dakota, while at the same time considering the EPA proposed rule. Information received by the commission will be used when preparing the commission's comments on the EPA's proposed rules. The written responses are due no later than October 28th.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
Maybe, Darrell, just to put a finer point on what this does, is that this directs MDU, Ottertail, and Xcel that they have to give us their comments. Just no cut and dried. And then the rest of it, whether it's a GRE or a Minn Kota Basin, we'd like to certainly get their comments over. I think the commission, we've heard from all these different groups. but this is really the documentation that we'll use as the commission figures out whether we're going to litigate this, what our future holds. This really sets the stage for North Dakota Public Service Commission to have a variety of tools in our toolkit as we figure out the best way to protect North Dakota consumers from what I consider a pretty extreme proposed rule. So I think that really sets it out. The one thing that I will say is that in my role in NARUC, I'm heavily involved in a lot of discussion up there. We're really starting to see through the NARUC avenues that the co-ops and the municipalities that aren't under our regulation are really starting to understand that this puts them under our jurisdiction. And so it'd be a colossal change in the way North Dakota energy regulation would be going forward. Not only is it, I think, a state's right to regulate energy generation, this could potentially put the co-ops and the munis under our jurisdiction. So that's something I don't think really became clear until the last couple of weeks in my mind. So I know that while there were some groups, I think, that were kind of straddling the fence a little bit about it, I've heard a lot from my friends in the co-ops and the munis that they really don't like this either because of that one provision. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in their network of arenas and their groups through D.C.
I think you hit on a really important point and why we need to open this comment period for a short window again. When you mentioned, you know, the evolution of the thought process here and that people are realizing that they might suddenly fall under a government jurisdiction and they didn't before, all kinds of other new thoughts have developed over the course of these months of various people taking comments and having meetings and such. And so this gives us a chance here as we enter the very last stretch before the deadline period for people to update their comments as well. And so it'll really freshen things for us so we can use that to make our comments.
Is there any further discussion? Since none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, motion is approved.
That concludes my portfolio, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Just thank Randy and Victor. I know, Victor, you did a lot of work on putting this together in a short period of time, so thank you for that. All right, Commissioner Fedorchak.
Okay, I have four items to work through this morning. The first one will be the longest. I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law, law and order, issuing certificate of corridor compatibility number 157 and route permit number 169 in Highland Crude LLC, crude oil pipeline, McKinsey, Williams, Montreal, citing application case number PU-13-136.
Second.
Excuse me. I didn't want to be sniffling the whole time. Okay, on March 27th of 2014, Highland filed with the Commission applications for a certificate of corridor compatibility and route permit to authorize the conversion of a gathering pipeline system in McKinsey, Montreal, and Williams counties into a transmission system. On May 6th, the Commission deemed Highland's applications complete and scheduled a hearing for June 17th, and on June 17th, the hearing was held as scheduled in Williston. The project consists of approximately 197 miles of pipeline located in McKinsey, Montreal, and Williams counties. The pipeline transports crude oil to major markets via five different systems. Enbridge Pipeline using a connection at Beaver Lodge, the Colt Rail Hub using a connection near Epping, the Plains Bakken North Pipeline at Trenton Station, the Savage Rail Station, and Enbridge Trenton Station using connections near Trenton, Musket Rail using a loading station near Door, North Dakota, with a potential connection to Highland's proposed Double H pipeline at the same location, and Bridger's Four Bears pipeline using a connection near Johnson's Corner. Just to give you a visual, especially you, Dave, out there, it's like a big flat C, a hook going right through the heart of all the main Bakken production area. The project utilizes 8-inch diameter steel crude oil pipeline, and the maximum operating pressure will be 1440 pounds of pressure per square inch. The maximum daily output will be 65,000 barrels per day. The project was built in six segments as gathering lines, with construction starting in 2010 and ending in the first quarter of 2014. The above ground facilities include mainline valves, block valves, pig launching and receiving stations, rectifiers, and pipeline markers, Highland intends to add tank facilities and pumps at several outlets to reduce overall line pressure and increase the maximum daily output of the system. And this is what triggered its conversion to a transmission line. The addition of the storage tanks and pumping facilities would provide a reliable transportation method for up to 65,000 barrels per day. The increase in the maximum daily output will reduce truck traffic and negate the need for a parallel pipeline, reducing even further the overall impact of crude oil transportation in the area. And the use of storage tanks will reduce overall pressure in the pipeline, thereby increasing the safety of the project. In terms of location, Highland evaluated a one-mile study area centered on the existing pipeline route, and field surveys were conducted on a 250-foot wide area centered on existing pipeline alignment. They conducted a Class 1 literature search and Class 3 cultural resources inventory in the survey area. Five or six different state and federal agencies were consulted, including Parks and Rec, Game and Fish, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and State Historic Preservation Officer. No agencies expressed concern with the project, and the SHPO has concurred with the determination that no historic properties or significant sites will be affected by the project. In terms of our siting criteria, a transmission facility route must not be sited within an exclusion area, and there are no exclusion areas impacted by this project. An avoidance area is a geographic area that may not be considered in routing of a transmission facility unless the applicant shows that under the circumstances there is no reasonable alternative. According to state law, areas within 500 feet of an inhabited rural residence must be designated as avoidance areas. That may be waived by the owner of the inhabited rural residence in writing. Additionally, PSC rules designate areas within 500 feet of a residence, school, or place of business are also avoidance areas. This project is within 500 feet of 20 rural residences. Waivers were obtained from all but five of the owners of the residences. So in terms of the five that did not provide waivers, four of these rural residences are within 500 feet of the pipeline, but the owners do not own the land on which the pipeline was built, so they're not easement holders of the land. They're neighbors of the pipeline. One of the rural residences within the 500 feet of the route is owned by a person who owns the property or is an easement holder of the project. Of these rural residences, one of them, Laverne and Juliana Vance, appeared at the public hearing and testified that they made requests to move the pipeline further from the Vance residence during construction, but they were unsuccessful. They also testified to receiving a letter from Highland seeking a waiver, but neither Highland nor Diamond Resources, another company involved in this, ever consulted with them further about the pipeline. The Vance's attorney also testified and described that the first time she was contacted by Highland was the day prior to the public hearing. Evidence provided by Highland about why waivers were not obtained was vague and speculative and indicated Highland used minimal efforts to obtain the waivers. Highland appears to rely upon the fact that the pipeline is already in place as a substitute for meaningful attempts to obtain waivers. The Commission finds that Highland has failed to show that no reasonable alternative exists to locating the pipeline within 500 feet of these rural residences. Economic considerations alone are not sufficient to establish no reasonable alternative exists to siting in an avoidance area. Highland's position appears to be that moving the pipeline is not a reasonable alternative because there would be additional environmental impact, inconvenience to landowners where the pipeline is located, and expense. However, Highland's argument is that no reasonable alternative exists because the pipeline is already constructed. However, the Commission is not convinced that this is the case and that it should be sited within 500 feet of these rural residents merely because Highland constructed this project in phases as gathering lines and then decided to convert it to a transmission. This situation could have been avoided by better planning. Highland has not sought approval or identified options to reroute the pipeline in the areas within reroute the pipeline in the areas within 500 feet of the rural residences and testified that it had not explored alternatives. Therefore, there is no information from which the Commission can find a different route meets the Commission's siting criteria. Accordingly, as a condition of Highland's requested certificate of corridor compatibility and route permit, Highland must obtain waivers from the owners of these five rural residences. With respect to the Keister residence, Highland asserts the signing of the easement is essentially the equivalent of the waiver under North Dakota law. Highland may file the easement obtained for the Keister property for the commission's evaluation of whether it satisfies the waiver requirement. Moving on to other specifics of the project crossed the Missouri River, which is an avoidance area. However, the pipeline was bored via horizontal drilling, did not impact this avoidance area. And further, given the location of the pipeline and its purpose, crossing the Missouri River is avoidable, therefore unavoidable. The commission finds that no reasonable alternative existed to avoiding the Missouri River. There were a number of wetlands and water bodies in the project area, but they were also bored, and therefore no adverse impacts occurred. Any trees or shrubs removed during construction of the project will be replaced in accordance with our tree and shrub mitigation specifications. It is appropriate to authorize a corridor only for the area of the survey, which is 250 feet on the center line of the pipeline route, subject to the condition that Highland obtain waivers from the owners of the five residences within 500 feet of the pipeline, for which the waivers haven't already been obtained. The design, construction, and operation of the pipeline must be in accordance with the U.S. Department of Transportation regulations governing the transportation of crude oil, included in regulations set forth in 49 CFR Part 195. This is an important criteria that really certifies that the pipeline was constructed to the high safety standards required of all pipeline construction in the country. And Highland participates testified at the hearing that they participate in the North Dakota One Call excavation notice system. It was a great comfort to Commissioner Kalk. And they also provided us with an emergency response plan that covers the full scope of this project and shows that they are fully prepared to operate this and manage it and respond to any potential disasters or leaks that might occur. So, therefore, this order provides a certificate of corridor compatibility number 157, route permit number 169, both subject to the condition that Highland obtained the waivers from the five properties that they haven't received yet. And to the extent that Highland may be unable to obtain the waivers, they may apply for a reroute to the extent allowed by existing state law. Just to kind of summarize, this is really a case of balance. We need to maximize our existing pipeline infrastructure in the state, and that's what this project attempts to do. I really appreciate that. This pipeline's already in the ground. With the addition of storage and pressure, they can get more out of that pipeline. That's a really important goal. At the same time, we need to build more pipelines in our state. And the key to building more pipelines is good landowner relations. We have to get landowners to sign off on the easements to allow the pipeline construction. The folks in this project, they're living within this infrastructure. This is their homes, and that's why these setbacks exist. It gives them the chance to know what's going on, to either approve the pipeline existing within that area or not. It's clear in both state law and rules that these setbacks are intended to protect the landowners that are living with this infrastructure. So to all the pipeline companies, and this one in particular, landowners need to be both consulted in advance and respected whenever possible and brought along as partners. We on the commission have a good track record of working with the companies to be efficient, fair, and reasonable regulators. At the same time, we expect companies to be operating at the highest standards and to accommodate reasonable landowner requests. And that's the only way that citizens are going to provide the easements necessary to build out the pipeline infrastructure that we need to have live in harmony with long-term energy development in our state. So I think this order attempts to provide that balance between what the company needs and what the landowner needs to live in harmony with this project.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I'll just maybe add a couple comments. I appreciate the work Commissioner Fedorchak and staff did in this order because it's a very complex order. It was a very complex hearing. I just wanted to highlight a couple things as well. One of the things that I think is challenging for folks to understand is just when the Public Service Commission cites a pipeline, what does that really mean? Our siting is more of an environmental siting. It's not a construction standards siting. As Commissioner Fedorchak pointed out, you know, Part 195 of the federal regs gives the companies what the construction standards are. And they don't really break out whether it's a gathering line or a transmission line. If you're going to build a pipeline, here's the standards that you build it towards, if it's close to people or what it might be. So when the company built this, the construction standards they used were appropriate for whatever this is going to be, a gathering line or a transmission line. So I'm not so much worried about the construction standards because they met the appropriate construction standards of this. What I do get concerned about is the North Dakota law that perhaps we have, not perhaps, that we're trusted with enforcing, and it says about the environmental review of this. And so for the commission to find a no reasonable alternative, there's got to be a really good reason that's in the record. And in cases of transmission lines that we've cited, other pipelines, when you're trying to thread the needle into a anchor point on a transmission line, you may go by homes that are within 500 feet, but there's no reasonable alternative because they got to get to that substation. And so that can be the same thing on a pipeline if you're trying to get to a certain area. But in these particular cases, there was no evidence that showed there was any discussion about other alternatives. And that really, you just can't say there's no reasonable alternative without something in the record that shows that. So I certainly support Commissioner Fedorchak's work on the order on this one. And I really just look forward to more discussion about what is a gathering line and transmission line as far as the siting for the North Dakota Public Service Commission, because there is some, it is potentially unclear in some areas what should be sited through the commission. But the good thing, though, is the construction standards are out there. And we've had a lot of discussion about what that means. But I would encourage companies, if you have a question, just ask us. We've had many companies come in with a jurisdictional determination, whether it's a power line, whether it's a energy generation facility. All companies have to do is ask us, and we'll tell them what we think, which sets the stage. So I think this is very appropriate order. And really, I think that kind of just sums it up. But just to reinforce that our siting is really an environmental review. And so that's the key thing, that it's very hard to do that full environmental review when that pipeline is already in the ground.
Is there further discussion?
One more thought. You brought up a good point about the increase in the number of transmission lines that are being converted from gathering lines. And I think it's important for companies in their construction of gathering lines to look at that issue ahead of time to decide, is it likely that this is going to be converted to a transmission line down the road? And if that's a possibility or a strong possibility, they ought to be siting it in a way that would allow it to be converted easily and would meet all these avoidance area criteria and et cetera that don't apply in a gathering line, but they are an important factor in a transmission line. And through better planning, they can avoid this kind of a challenge in moving a project forward down the road.
Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion is approved.
Moving to a totally different area of work. I move the commission issue a notice of filing, a notice of opportunity for hearing in Northern States Power Company's 2014-2015 transmission facility cost recovery rates, case number PU-14-644.
Second.
On February 26th of 2014, the PSC issued an order approving a transmission cost recovery tariff rider pursuant to the North Dakota Century Code Section 4905-04 for XL Energy operating in North Dakota. On July 22nd, 2014, NSP filed its TCR, that's Transmission Cost Recovery Tariff, requesting approval of cost recovery for specific projects and resulting in a average increase in rates of $1.50 per month for a typical residential customer in North Dakota. This puts out a notice of an opportunity for a hearing. Anybody with comments or wanting to request a hearing must let us know by November 12th. And just a few other details on this project. This is the first Transmission Recovery Tariff for NSP. This was approved in our, or made possible in our rate case settlement last year. These rates, if approved, would be in place till the end of 2015, and really would include the costs recovered in two ways. First, it would be the North Dakota share of costs for transmission facilities that are not currently recovered in base rates, and also the MISO costs allocated to North Dakota retail customers, so the costs of MISO-related transmission projects that are not that are allocated to North Dakota customers. There's five projects listed that have already been approved by the commission for with an advanced determination of prudence. Some of the large ones are the CapEx 2020 Fargo to Twin Cities lines and the Brookings to the Twin Cities lines line that we've already provided ADP for. And then 20 projects that fall under the threshold, the minimum threshold for an advanced determination of prudence that, you know, various transmission projects for NSP throughout its operating territory. So this is a first look we'll have at this transmission recovery. The reason why we allowed that this rider is because there's a lot of transmission projects occurring throughout this footprint. And we don't want the transmission projects by themselves generating rate increases. So this is a good method for allowing the companies to recover those costs without going into a full-blown rate increase. And it would provide more streamlined increase in rates for customers as well.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
Maybe, Daryl, just the... as much as we need pipelines in North Dakota, the transmission line build-out is just as much needed. We've got some major projects that we've approved and are under construction. Some are completed, a different company, but that Senator Grand Forks line has been completed now and energized. It's out there. The CapEx lines are nearing completion. It's just that we're going through this big energy revolution in the state. It's not just oil development. It's electricity development and movement. So these transmission lines that are being built are to replace lines that are aging, but also to meet new demand throughout the Midwest. And so the earlier motion about Southwest Power Pool, us intervening with FERC, the commission, I think, is going to have a renewed interest in how all these transmission costs get spread apart behind MISO and Southwest Power Pool. I know that when Commissioner Wiefold was on the commission, she spent a significant amount of her time when MISO was being set up making sure these cost formulas were fair and adequate. And Otter Tail and MDU have different times had discussion about moving out of MISO. But I see the commission, particularly Jerry Lane and myself, spending a lot more time the next couple of years on these transmission projects and how the cost of North Dakota ratepayers lays itself out. So more to follow for sure.
Just to add a little bit, too, in terms of the driver of these costs, another big driver of the development of new transmission projects is the bringing on of additional renewable resources in our footprint, especially wind. And so it takes a lot of new transmission to incorporate the wind projects that are occurring throughout our system. And this is one of the big drivers for this, the increase in transmission projects, and therefore the increase in cost to customers to pay for these transmission projects. So we get a lot of questions sometimes, why do you approve these rate increases? Why do you allow this to happen? And there, you know, I try to explain to customers, first, we have to have reliable services, so the companies have to be reinvesting in their plant. And secondly, renewable energy is driving the need for additional transmission resources, and that costs money as well. So in order to meet these environmental goals, we have to be spending some money to have the systems in place to do that.
I want to maybe quantify down a little bit more on that. I agree with you on the renewables, but the the way I see some of these transmission projects, it's states outside of North Dakota want our energy, whether in particular the wind energy. So they've got other states to have that renewable mandate. So they're willing to kick in on the transmission costs. So North Dakota customers are benefiting from other states' desire to have our renewables. And so we're building these transmission projects to meet other states' desires to get wind energy, but we're benefiting because they're picking up a big cost of this transmission. And so it's absolutely true that the wind is driving some of this transmission. But I will say that it does help North Dakota build transmission, because for Xcel Energy to build some of these projects alone would be very, very challenging. When you get other areas to kick in on it, like this line that we just approved, the Ellendale to South Dakota line. It's only 10 miles, but it has access to that big transmission grid. We're paying about, you know, a tenth of the cost of that transmission line, but it's going to open up a huge pathway for more North Dakota generation to go to different markets. And you're right, it's predominantly wind in that case. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's best cases where the being involved in these regional organization benefits us. We just have to make sure it benefits us all the time, or as much as we can.
Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion is approved.
JF3, I move the commission issue a notice of filing and notice of opportunity for hearing and Otter Tail Power Company fuel clause adjustment C-CSAPR Casper tariff case number PU-14-668.
Second.
On July 31st, Otter Tail Power Company filed an application for revisions to its energy adjustment rider tariff to include recovery of costs for, one, purchased emission allowances that may be needed to comply with the Federal Environmental Protection Agency's cross-state air pollution rule, otherwise known as CSAPR, and two, reagent expenses associated with emission controls being installed to comply with EPA's Mercury and Air Toxic Standards, or MATS, rule. Those interested are invited to comment on the application in writing, or persons desiring a hearing must file a written request prior to November 12th of 2014. This project, as I stated, really, this tariff is being adjusted to include costs that Otter Tail Power is anticipating or incurring from purchasing both NOx and SOx allowances to meet the EPA requirements for their two Minnesota plants, the Solway Gas Peaker plant and the Hoot Lake Small Coal Plant. And then they have to, it also will recover costs for reagent expenses used to extract the NOx, SOx, and mercury to comply with EPA's MATS rule for Big Stone and Coyote 2. The impact to customers would be approximately 74 cents per month for North Dakota customers.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion is approved.
And I move the commission suspend the tariff filing and issue a notice of filing, notice of opportunity for hearing, and Otter Tail Power Company 2014 transmission facility cost recovery rates case number PU-14-690.
Second.
This is similar to the NSP order. On August 29th, Otter Tail Power filed an annual update to its transmission cost recovery rider. The increase for the typical residential customer would be about $2.06 per month. Any members of the public interested in commenting or requesting a hearing must do so by November 12th. This rider has been in existence for a number of years. I want to say it's since 2008, but I'm not completely sure. 2007 or 8, if I'm remembering correctly from last year. 12 projects that have been included already in this rider, including CapEx 2020, Fargo, and Bemidji, and a number of others throughout the area. And then there's two new ones that they're adding, a transformer replacement that's being done along the border of South Dakota and Minnesota, and was interested to note costs for the Spiritwood Generation interconnection upgrade. This was an interconnection developed for Otter Tail Power and Great River Energy to bring on board the Spiritwood generator, which, according to this, is expected to become operational in November of 2014. So we'll learn more about these projects and everything included in this as we evaluate this application in more detail.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion is approved.
Okay. Anything else, Commissioner?
That's it. Thank you.
All right, just a couple closing comments. We have an informal, several informals this afternoon, a variety of work sessions. Next week is the Association of Counties, where I think the three commissioners will be dropping in. Commissioner Fedorchuk's on a panel, I know.
Yep.
And so we're looking forward to discussion with the counties on what's going on in energy development and hearing their viewpoints. We've got two hearings October 23rd, Antelope Hills Wind Project, and also that afternoon dealing with the associated transmission lines. That'll be in Beulah, District 33. And that's all that I have today. Commissioner Crisp, anything for you?
Well, just lightly, in JF3, when I looked at that acronym for the cross-state air pollution rule, I was trying to figure out how I would enunciate that, and all I could come up with was CSAPR. So your CASPR certainly sounded better than what I was able to come up with. Secondly, I just wanted to point out that since we hadn't discussed it, both of the Bison football winning streaks that are gripping the nation have continued on and marching forward.
All right, go Hazen and SU. Commissioner Fedorchuk?
I have no opposing comments.
All right, any questions from the audience?
Would it be safe to say that Casper spooked the utilities? Sorry. About the Highland. I know. About the Highland pipeline thing, since the pipeline is existing, what is to prevent Highland from coming back and saying, "Oh, pipeline's in the ground. Let's go ahead anyway."
They could decide they don't want to convert it to a transmission facility and continue operating it as a gathering facility without the storage and without the pressure.
But what if they start? What kind of enforcement action does the commission have if Highland decides to stake out a ground saying, "We've got the pipeline in place now. We're going to go ahead and build things"?
They can't do that under state law. They have to receive a permit for this to operate under as a transmission line, which is what it would be, so we could find them.
But it's a conditional approval for that transmission permit.
It's conditional, so they can get the waivers, or they can come up with an alternative route around that section of those areas where they are within 500 feet. They could move the line. And they could come up with an alternative route. So those are their two options for meeting the conditions of the permit and then proceeding as they have planned.
Do they have to come back to the commission then? Or?
I think they just have to verify to us that they've met those, providing the requirements. If they have to reroute, they'll probably have to come back to the commission because I don't think their corridor is big enough to reroute within and still get outside of the setback. But I haven't looked at the route that closely in those areas to see if they could still just move outside and still be within the 250-foot corridor. Perhaps they could. They could. But we'd be in discussion with them on a reroute. I'm sure they'd be working with our staff pretty closely on plans to reroute. And if they go outside what's already been surveyed and et cetera, then they'd have to provide the surveys. And we have the ability to provide reroutes with different conditions and requiring different filings both for within the corridor and outside the corridor.
I guess the point would be then that they cannot break ground on the tanks or anything like that, that they need to convert it until they get permission from these five landowners.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's exactly the way I would see it too, Dave. Is it just like other things that we issue out contingent upon SHPO final concurrence? We watch the companies and wait, and they don't do anything until we get the final concurrence. It gets filed, we acknowledge it, and then move forward on it.
All right. Commissioner Crisman, concerning the order that was issued to have your three investor-owned utilities file comments with the commission, I'm just curious, where in the statute do you have the authority to do that? Do you know if there a specific that you have the authority to tell those three utilities we need to have your comments?
I don't think it's specified. I think just our overall regulatory jurisdiction over them would cover that they answer these questions.
And the plan is once you get their comments, then the commission could draft its own response then.
Correct. It'll help us to draft comments as well as possible on behalf of both the utility providers. I mean, this is something that I would think they're anxious to do, as well as the citizens of the state.
But I also found it interesting. I'd never heard that brought up before, that the rural power cooperatives may be under your jurisdiction if this rule goes forward. I thought that was very interesting.
Well, the way I'd, Randy put me, jump in too, of course, but the way I read through it was basically, if these rules go through on CO2, somebody's got to certify that the companies are doing what they're supposed to do. So who would certify that other than the state commissions? So if Basin Electric is held to some standard of what they can generate in CO2, it's more than likely, it looks like state commissions would be the ones that would then oversee that. So that's where they would then, in my viewpoint, fall under our jurisdiction.
One of the four, go ahead.
For the addition to that, these rules and have a stand to impact the rates of customers, and we have clear jurisdiction over rates. So that, I think that would establish our jurisdiction for requiring them to report to us on how they feel about this, on how it would impact them, their service, and their rates.
Yeah, the first paragraph of the order really lays out all the different 490203, 490601 about why we believe that definitely falls under our jurisdiction. And we'd asked the companies ahead of time that we wanted to see their filings before they submitted them so we could see if there's anything that we missed in our filing. This really just formalizes it, and applaud Randy's work on this because he's right about that.
And gets a closing date so yeah. we can move forward. I wanted to say, regarding your other question, one of the four building blocks in the EPA's proposal had to do with energy efficiency requirements. And that's, to me, where the municipal electric systems and the cooperative electric systems are going to have to fall under somebody's jurisdiction if that becomes a reality, because how can you build a system to reduce CO2 counting on certain efficiency requirements being met if no one has the authority to do something about it, if a particular company is not getting their customers to meet that? And so it's not said directly, but it really goes without saying that they would have to fall under someone's jurisdiction then.
The law of perhaps unintended consequences?
I think that the EPA's proposal on this probably sets a record of all proposals for being full of the most unintended consequences.
Also, if I could add, Dave, the order requires the companies to submit comments, their comments to us, I don't think any of us felt that they weren't going to. They were going to, so this isn't going to be any big, heavy-handed push for them. But it also invites public comment, and so that was something that we hadn't really expressed before or previously invited public comment on these rules, and so this does that as well. Okay. Makes that official and sets a time frame for that.
When, Missouri River Energy was just in talking about their concerns, their municipality, of course, operates in North Dakota. And then now that we have a docket opened up in this, and then as the companies file their companies, individual citizens file their comments, we'll put them all in that one big docket. That would be our reference as potentially litigation goes forward. It's just, I think it's the right thing to do. The back to the co-op piece is that I don't want to infer that I have any desire to regulate co-ops. So that would be one of those things that I think would be against us doing so.
And then just on the northern excavation.
Yes.
What is their argument?
We will wait and see what their argument is. Victor from advocacy staff, he prepared the case, and I think that we'll have to wait and see, I guess. In these cases, there usually tends to be, my perception is, the discussion between advocacy staff and the companies on both sides, whether it's those following the complaint or those that are alleged, the three of them sit around and kind of discuss what happened. In this case, it appears that Northern Excavating has not really been forthcoming with advocacy staff, and so therefore they filed their complaint with the appropriate fines. So I don't believe I, and that's, I guess, what will come out for me in the hearing.
That 7 seems to be very, very high at this point.
It does, and if you look at the consent that's coming up, there's 8 more that are coming dealing with Northern Excavating. So, and this has happened over a period of time, and so it's not like they kind of built. I mean, they went through a period of July and September last year, so it seems like there's an ongoing I don't want to make any decisions here. There's a lot of cases that are coming our way dealing with northern excavating over a long period of time.
But it's all in just involving the same area, reservation telephone, and
this particular case is all reservation telephone.
Same with the other ones that are on the consent?
No. I'll turn over to Victor on that.
No, the other cases, a few of them are related to the same area in Ross, but there are, I don't believe there are any other reservation telecom items. There are some MDU items. I forget the other ones off the top of my head, but there are multiple other utilities involved.
But this is by far the biggest recommended fines we've received from advocacy staff. Okay. Julie, any closing thoughts?
No.
Randy?
No.
Okay, let's close the official portion of our meeting and reconvene again in, 10 minutes' worth, everybody?
Sure.
Okay, thank you all.